ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Australia's always been the lucky country. Sunshine, beaches, and that one magpie that always seems to know where you live.
Yeah, get away from my chip, please. Luck might not cut it anymore.
So can we make our own luck and turn this complicated world to our advantage?
That's our global roaming summer season. Can Australia surf the world's chaos without wiping out?
Fresh new episodes all summer. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri, Woiwurrung and Bunurong people of the Kulin Nation, this is Life Matters on Radio National Summer, bringing you some of your favourite stories from the year. Hey there, I'm Beverly Wang. When you got dressed this morning, how did you decide what to wear? Maybe the weather played a factor, but did you also think about how certain items of clothing would make you feel or the message they'd send? Today, we're exploring how we use clothing to tell our stories and also the aunties weigh in on dealing with your new desk buddy whose eating habits are, well, frankly, disgusting. Let's talk. So thinking about the power of clothing, I immediately went back to primary school years and one particular jumper I owned around grade 5 and 6. And this jumper, or sweatshirt, as we say in Canada, was from a particularly coveted name brand. It was white, had a big logo, and it was a gift to me because being a name brand, it was on the expensive side and definitely beyond my family's normal budget for clothes. Anyway, I loved that jumper so much and wore it so much because it was a passport to fitting in. It made me feel like I belonged when I really felt like I didn't. And it was doing a lot more heavy lifting than just keeping me warm. And I wore it so much that the fabric thinned out. You could see daylight through it in some parts. And that's just one of my clothing stories. I'd love to know how you use your clothes to help you face the world. Do you use clothing to impress? Do you dress to impress or to camouflage? Do you dress to embody particular ideals or broadcast your beliefs? And who or where did you learn this all from? Liz Sunshine, a fashion photographer and creator of the Not Buying Clothes Project and the Smith Street Agency, and Dr. Harriet Richards, a senior lecturer in the School of Fashion and Textiles at RMIT University. Welcome to you both.
Hi, babe.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. Now, Liz, can I start with you? Because I know that you grew up on a farm and moved into city fashion photography, which is a big leap. How did it all come about?
Yeah, so I grew up on a farm in New South Wales and I was there until I was about 16 when we moved to Canberra, and I think I discovered fashion for the first time. I probably fell in love much like every other teenage girl and sort of haven't looked back since, really.
Yeah, and the leap into fashion photography, though. I mean, a lot of people come to the city and find a new fashion identity, but you really went deep. You really basically got into the industry.
Yeah, no, I did. In my early 20s, I became quite obsessed with street style or fashion documentary and what we wear. And studying that. So I've been documenting that now for 16 years and started a project 3 years ago that studies our relationship with clothes and questions fashion. Mm.
So I mentioned that paper-thin sweatshirt or jumper that I wore nearly to death because it was like the one name brand item that got me, you know, a sense of normalcy. Do you have anything similar, Liz?
I have, honestly, I have so many stories about all of my clothes, and I've really been unpacking those recently. I don't think I have something that I've owned for as long as that. But when I was a child, my grandmother used to collect clothes from the Salvation Army and send us, me and my two sisters, boxes of clothing from Canberra, and that was our way of shopping. That was how we dressed until we were 16. So I really didn't shop before that point. That was my outlet.
Harriet, what about you? You are a fashion academic, but going personal, have you got an item of clothing from any era in your life that you think of as kind of really significant or, you know, like kind of like that special armor or something that helped you become you?
Yeah, I'm pretty sentimental about clothes. I've got boxes of clothes under the bed that I've had for such a long time that I just can't get rid of. And when I first moved to Melbourne when I was 22, I spent a lot of weekends going to the Camberwell Market and buying all sorts of things. I haven't been to the Camberwell Market in years, but the stalls used to be so amazing. And I'd go, I worked in a restaurant and I'd have my tip money. And I'd go with like a $50 note and I would spend the whole $50 and I would come home with like bags of clothes. And I would buy beautiful vintage things that then, if they didn't fit me, I'd send them back to New Zealand to family over there. Mm. And I remember I've got, some beautiful things in those boxes under the bed that maybe don't fit me anymore, but I can't seem to get rid of them. They just remind me of that time in my life.
Yeah, $50 going that far, also a bit nostalgic for those days
exactly.
as well. In a world, Harriet, where fashion is both self-expression and big business, how do you see people navigating that tension between personal style and pressure to consume?
Oh, it's a really challenging one. I've actually got a student this semester who's doing a really interesting project about personal style and the rise of like algorithmic culture on social media and how social media has sped up trends but also kind of created a uniformity and a homogenization. So there's this kind of dual thing going on that we're seeing a kind of availability of any sort of trend. So anything goes, especially in a big city like Melbourne. Like you can see people dressing, drawing on trends from the 80s, the 90s, the early 2000s, and especially in a classroom of fashion students, you see all sorts. But then you look online and there is this increasing uniformity. And I mean, I think of that quite viral New Yorker article from a couple of weeks ago about the West Village girl, and she's wearing just like a uniform of a white t-shirt and she's got her jeans and her Adidas Sambas. So I think there's these dual things going on. There's an opportunity and there's just so much fashion available. But at the same time, there's kind of this leaning into a uniform style where everyone looks the same. And I think it's very difficult to navigate that terrain.
Yeah, well, I think of a work uniform and it's just some things I just put on automatically because I don't need to think about it. But Liz, you spent years capturing what people wear in real time. What draws your eye when someone walks past?
I think it's a commitment, like a head-to-toe commitment to a particular style, to a personal style. I'm less interested in trends, but obviously as you document more and more people on the street, or you tend to see trends sort of emerge. I think we live in a time where, like Harriet said, like fashion, we have this opportunity for fashion to be really personal, like clothing is more available than ever, but we are seeing the homogenization of like what's socially acceptable, the story of that sort of online is prolific. And we're sort of seeing this like one character kind of emerging rather than looking at clothes as a personal reflection of, you know, your story and who you are.
And Liz, does that frustrate you or is that just kind of just part and parcel of social media?
I just think it's interesting. I don't have any judgment towards either way of dressing. I think that it's such a personal and nuanced and complicated, you know, form of showing our identity it doesn't frustrate me. It's just interesting. It's kind of just the world that we live in and I'm here to document that.
Yeah. Let's take our first caller. Ken is in New South Wales. Welcome to Life Matters, Ken. And I think you want to talk about your impeccably attired late mother. Is that correct?
No, I'm concerned at this particular moment that I'm appropriately dressed to be speaking with you.
Well, you're on the radio, so you could be wearing anything.
Thank heavens for that.
Yeah.
But my mother... I'm an only child. I was brought up in the 1950s. My mother was a good Presbyterian. Going to church was the big dress-up day, and but it pervaded every step of my only child life that I had to be colour coordinated. Is the expression that rings most strongly in my mind. Nothing to do with whether I had a brand name on me. That would have been unthinkable, Beverly. Unthinkable. And so my the socks had to match, and we would go to Myers in Melbourne, and we would choose the tie to go with the shirt, but she would have to take the shirt and the tie and me to a natural light we'd have to go out to the back somewhere where a bit of light shone into the building, because the colour would shift with the tone of the light. You know?
Oh, so she was trying to match it to her outfit as well?
No. It was just within my own outfit.
I see.
But yes, it all had to fit, and it's still with me, Beverly. I can't wave it goodbye. If I ride a motorbike, and I have to make sure that my socks underneath my motorbike boots are not, you know, they wouldn't clash with probably with the motorbike. They wouldn't clash.
And so, whenever you think that, does it remind you of your mum?
Oh, look, she died 50 years ago, Beverly.
Oh, wow.
And it does. It does remind me. She's still there in that. It's a judgmental thing, I suppose, that she wanted me to take pride in my appearance. This was the expression. Take a pride in your appearance, Kat. Yeah. And so I would be seen to be well-groomed. This was another expression, to be well-groomed. This was it. She was very concerned for how she looked for the occasion, and everything had to match perfectly.
Ken, thank you so much for calling and sharing. You've just painted such a vivid picture of, you know, your mum standing in the light trying to see the tones of the clothing. Harriet, can I come to you? Because what Ken's talked about, this, you know, how you present to the world, and also you're getting up, getting dressed, you know, in your good clothes on a Sunday. That is such a thing that I think many people can relate to. And it makes me think of even like the recent Met Gala when they had dandyism on show. And I think one of the ideas was that as working class people, you know, black working men and women, they had to dress a certain day, 6 days of the week, but on Sunday they could shine and show their dandy. And I just wonder if you can talk to us a little bit of, you know, history of how, you know, what being dressed up in your Sunday best, how that's changed over the years and the significance of that.
Sure. I was actually thinking of the Met Gala on my way in this morning. And what an interesting example that is, or that idea of taking the clothes of the oppressor, as the history of the black dandy really encapsulates, and using that as a tool of resistance. And that's perhaps a little bit different from getting up, dressed up to go to church on a Sunday. But I think the two things go hand in hand in terms of using clothes as a way to represent ourselves to the world. So, you know, in the absence of words or knowing anything about someone, we make judgments based on how someone looks. And that's just a fact of life. And I think in the example of Ken, which is, as you say, such a beautiful picture of this history and these memories, but I imagine for Ken's mother, you know, how her son was perceived was also a reflection on her and her role as a mother too. So, you know, that extends beyond the self to the ones we care for as well, and the ones who we have responsibility for. And I think, I mean, there's sometimes critiques that, you know, we don't take such pride in our appearance anymore, or people don't get dressed up, you know, we no longer wear hats or gloves and have our little handbag to go into town. But I think clothing has evolved, and that's something that fashion is really good at. And perhaps now we have clothes that are more comfortable than maybe we did in the 50s, or are more practical, or are more suitable to different weather conditions. So there's a really evolving relationship that we have with those clothes over time. And so it's not necessarily a bad thing that we're maybe more casual than we used to be, and we don't see that that tradition of getting dressed up on a Sunday. Certainly people still get dressed up for certain events. Those events perhaps have just changed, and the expectations have changed as well on what dressing up means.
Yes, absolutely. This is Life Matters on Radio National. I'm Beverly Wang, and the voice you just heard there is Dr. Harriet Richards, a senior lecturer in the School of Fashion and Textiles at RMIT University. I'm also with Liz Sunshine, a fashion photographer and creator of the Not Buying Clothes Project. Maybe you follow Liz on social media. I know a lot of people do, and follow her photography. And over to NAR Melbourne, where Nerida is standing by. Tell me about how you use clothes to tell your story to the world, Nerida.
Hi, Beverly. Yeah, I guess I grew up with two parents. I grew up in the U.S. I've been in Australia for quite a long time. And two parents who are just impeccably dressed. And some of Ken's words really resonated with me, like where you match your belt to your shoes, to your bag. And I'm not necessarily that way now, but I think clothing does say something about me and that I care, you know, like I'm 55 and I'm single and I like to get dressed up. I went out to a concert last night and, you know, just being a bit on trend, but not super trendy and just stylish and wearing my bomber jacket and I have my little hat and my little retro sneakers. And I love that. It makes me feel really good. And it makes a statement. Like I'm not someone, I don't walk down to the shops in workout gear. I just, you know, when I wear my workout gear, I'm going to the gym. Like, it's kind of about making a little bit of an effort, and it makes me feel better. I'm feeling a bit flat and just put a nice outfit on I love it. I think clothing is amazing and, yeah. Mm.
That's a great story, Nerida. I love to hear, you know, how even just a little detail can make you kind of change your posture up a little bit. But I wonder what your thought is on, you know, you say you wear workout clothes just to work out. But obviously, we know that that is not the case in kind of the wider world of Australia. Just walk on the street, you'll know people are wearing workout clothes for anything. You know, athleisure is a thing. Do you have any kind of thought on the prevalence of athleisure?
It's not something, as I said, if I'm going to the gym or for a walk, it's not something I throw on. Like I'm about to walk down to the Vic Market. I'm going to put, you know, nice pair of jeans on and a nice jacket. I just, you know, it's just, I feel like we've become a bit too casual, and I've seen also in traveling and, you know, growing up and getting on a plane, you got a bit dressed up, and now it's like people just roll up in pajamas and that's cool. I'm not trying to be judgy, but it's just like, it's an occasion. Things are an occasion and they're moments, and it's nice to honor that. So that when you get dressed, yeah.
Yeah. Thank you, Nerida. I really appreciate your call and your input. Liz Sunshine, can I come to you? Because I know that you are engaged. I know you love fashion, but you're engaged in this project of not buying any clothing. Can you talk a little bit about why and how that came to be?
Yeah, absolutely. So since the beginning of 2022, I've been reducing my consumption. So in 2022, I realized I was like an average Australian consumer, which is buying about 56 items a year. And since then, I've been stepping it down. And in July last year, I just had this feeling that I wanted to take 12 months off shopping, have a big dramatic pause, and kind of like reset my relationship with clothes. So I have just been wearing the clothes I own and talking about it on social and Substack. And I'm finding it really liberating. I can't believe how quickly the time has passed and how little I've actually needed within that time. And while I can't wait to go shopping again, it will also look really, really different. So I feel like I've really been able to reset my relationship with clothes, and it will kind of never be the same past that point.
Well, that's really interesting because I think we are living in a time where people are really budget conscious. So you may not have chosen not to buy clothes for budget reasons, but there are definitely people who are cutting back for that reason. What's your advice, I guess, for people who are living on a budget and might hear this and think, well, I can't be part of this conversation because I don't have a budget to buy new clothes. How can those of us who aren't out there shopping every day still figure out some kind of unique connection with our wardrobe choices?
I think that's actually like a common misconception is that like to participate in fashion and to have a strong relationship with clothes, you need new things. I actually think it's the opposite. I actually think that I'm strengthening my relationship with clothes and the things I have and realigning my values by not shopping. And that's kind of the point. So when I was listening to the stories before about, you know, the mother and the tie, you know, I was thinking about how we willingly like let clothes come in and out of our lives really quickly. And that comes down to shopping. Whereas if we actually stop shopping and we start wearing the things that we own, we're imbuing memories in, you know, the cloth of the jeans that we're pulling out every week. And so I actually think it's stronger on the other way. I don't think we need new things. So budget aside, I think you have a relationship with clothes.
But we have this fashion industry, Harriet, which is based on seasonality. Mm-hmm. I myself have never understood it or met anybody who flips their wardrobe or buys a new one every season, but this is the way the fashion industry works. So there's messaging from the fashion industry that's kind of telling us that that's what we ought to be doing if we're engaging in fashion. I'd just love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the fashion industry is incredibly powerful because it's an aspirational industry. So it's making us want things, and it's incredibly adept at making us want things and creating desire. There's often a question when it comes to ethics and sustainability about the responsibility of the consumer. And I think that's always very difficult because I say, well, the industry is built on creating desire and making you want to buy new things. So if you're saying that the responsibility lies with the consumer, they're up against a really challenging, adversary, I guess, if you like. I don't know a lot of people who buy a whole new wardrobe or flip their wardrobe. It's also hard living in Melbourne because, the seasons are all over the place. So it's when you put your winter things away, you might get a cold snap, in the middle of summer. So that's difficult to do. But I think when we're considering the relationship with clothes and listening to what Liz is saying there, there's a concept that we talk to our students about called emotional durability. So it's really that idea of imbuing our clothes with stories and getting to know our clothes so that they're not just an object that's kind of like something disposable, something that we can throw away without thinking about it, but it's actually we have this emotional connection. And I think that's sometimes difficult to do when we have T-shirts that we've bought quite cheaply, because we don't think of them as having, inbuilt value. And I think a lot about the concept of value and how we value our clothes, especially when it comes to thinking about how they're made, what the supply chain is, who has made them, and how we consider value. And in our capitalist society, we think a lot about value in terms of monetary value. But of course, there's all these other forms of value, like the stories that we've been hearing are really making clear that emotional value, that nostalgic value, those other forms of value that I think are often overlooked and are much more important than we often give credit.
We've got lots of callers coming in, so I'm going to go to Judith on Gadigal Land in Sydney. And you have a very special jumper knitted by your mum. Is that right, Judith?
I do. 58 years ago, my mother knitted me a cream broucle Aran pattern sweater. I don't wear it anymore. I cannot get rid of it. It's very preciously packed in plastic. And when I take it out, I see her arthritic hands knitting this with great love.
That's so beautiful. What are your plans for the future of this jumper, Judith?
I have a niece who's interested in textiles, so I'm going to ask if she would like to become the new custodian.
That's so lovely. And do you remember when your mum knitted that jumper? Do you remember, any stories of when she was knitting it, or what do you think of, or what do you envision when you see that jumper still?
One, apart from the love that she poured into it, many a boyfriend since has wanted to run away with it.
It's a precious item. And that's a really precious story. Judith, thank you so much for calling and sharing that. I'm with Liz Sunshine and Dr. Harriet Richards on Life Matters on Radio National. And we have Ines on Ngunnawal Country in Canberra. Welcome to Life Matters, Ines. What's your story with clothing?
I really enjoy dressing. And to keep up with new fashion, I just buy accessories that are in the colors. So, for example, at the moment, purple is coming back. So you just need an accessory or buy a jumper for that and then go back to your wardrobe and combine things. That's what I would like to teach the young generation. I am so sad when they throw their clothes away because I take pride in having clothes that are 20 years old and going back to them.
Mm. Yeah, that's such
I come from Argentina when fashion is very important. And it's a sense you have to find your own style and don't be a slave to fashion. Mm. I buy a lot of things from vintage stores, and the quality is quite amazing. So that's what I would like to pass on to the new generation, is to find your own style and have fun, you know? And when you go out, you part of you is on show with the clothes that you wear. So that's my message for today.
I really appreciate that message, Inez. And Liz and Harriet, I'm sure you're like me, you're wondering what the inside of Inez's wardrobe looks like with all of the different clothes and the accessories as well. I wish I could see a picture, Inez. You've painted a really beautiful picture. But Liz, can I come to you? Because I think, you know, Inez makes an interesting point that her clothes are durable. But fast fashion these days is actually not made to last as long. And that's part of the issue, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. We're seeing clothes that are made to be disposable. And we're seeing women, a lot of Australian women, really like jump on the bandwagon of buying those clothes. And there's sort of no value on either way. So it's kind of like you're just donating your money, because those clothes are never going to last. And they cycle in and out of your wardrobe really quickly. So looking to vintage clothing and clothing that already exists and is really well made is definitely an opportunity to strengthen your relationship with clothes and to strengthen your style. And owning clothes for a long time is something we should all be really proud of. So like Inez has said, owning something for 20 years is amazing. I think we need to flip the narrative on its head and say that's true, and that actually, like, wearing a completely new outfit every week is possibly not, it says something about your style. It says something about how well you know yourself, and it's probably the opposite of owning something for 20 years.
Harriet, as an instructor in this industry, how are you seeing concern for the environment? Is that something that you see more students coming through the door express a concern for?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I've been teaching in this field for a number of years now, and the awareness has simply risen over that time. But what is persistent, despite the increase in awareness and attitudes around concern for the environment and concern for the social ethics of fashion production, is, as I said before, the continuing prevalence of desire for new objects and new fashion items. So it's what, you know, to use more of this academic jargon, we call the attitude behavior gap. So we might have an attitude that says, I want to be really ethical and sustainable with my consumption, but then my actual behavior is against that. So we see that especially with a lot of Gen Z consumers, and that's what some of my students are really interested in discovering, why that's the case. And it is a lot to do with the fashion industry's strength in being aspirational and creating this kind of sense and expectation that you have to wear certain things in order to fit in, or in order to be cool, or in order to be a certain sort of person. Whereas I think the stories that we're hearing today really, as Liz said, you know, flip that on its head and tell us something completely different, and that we can be cool, if not cooler, if we really lean into our own personal style and wear the clothes that we already have. But I think for a young generation who are figuring out who they are, that can be incredibly challenging. So they may have this incredible environmental awareness, but research that I've done as well shows that even with that awareness and knowledge, it can be incredibly challenging to navigate the fashion industry, to figure out where to shop ethically and sustainably, really authentically. And so, you know, then people decide not to shop, or they just shop secondhand, thinking that's my only alternative, especially if there's, you know, financial constraints involved as well. So it's difficult, I think, is the short answer.
It's a challenge.
Yeah.
We have so many calls coming in, so I'm going to jump straight over to Leanne on Unawa Country, Canberra. Welcome to Life Matters, Leanne. What are your clothing memories?
Oh, good morning, Beverly. My immediate family have all passed away, so my mom, my sister and my dad, but I still wear clothes that my mom and my sister used to own, and wearing them, it feels like I'm getting a hug from them. So it's a lovely experience, and it's a lovely story. And when people compliment me, I say, this was my mum's from when she was a teenager, or this was my sister's from when she was at work, or things like that. Yeah, and I actually have a really special shirt that my dad bought the day I was born because he wanted something nice to wear to the hospital to meet me. And so I still have that, and it's like a dark colour. So in my teenage years, when I was going through my goth emo phase, I would wear that as part of my identity as that sort of subgenre of being an emo in that scene. So, yeah.
That is so cool, Leanne. And that's just such a lovely story to hear how those clothes remind you of your family who have passed away. I guess if I could ask a question, I know that when a family member dies, you know, one of the big questions that comes up is, what do we do with all of their possessions? What do we do with all their clothes? Would you mind just sharing maybe a bit of advice or thoughts for people who might be dealing with that right now? What's a good way to go through that, and also not just decide what to keep, but also how to give something away without feeling all the feelings, or how to deal with those feelings?
Yeah, I think the first thing is, don't rush. If you have the opportunity, just keep things that you think you might like. Don't rush into making a decision straight away, and then as you go through the grieving process and the memories come back, you may have items that you can attribute to that memory that you want to hang on to. And I have a number of those pieces, not only clothes as well, that I share stories with my children about, the time that, you know, your Nana and I went to the shop and bought this vase, or, this was your great grandmother's sewing machine, or anything like that. I think telling your story to your to your children and to your friends, it makes you more human and, I guess, connected in a way. Yeah.
That's beautiful. Leanne, thank you so much for calling in and sharing on Life Matters. It's really nice to hear from you. And we have another Leanne standing by on Bundjalung Country, New South Wales. Welcome to Life Matters, Leanne. What's your clothing story that you'd like to share this morning?
Oh, thank you, Bev. In 1989, I was in Kenya in Africa, and as a sort of mid-20-year-old. And I never buy T-shirts that have slogans on them or anything sort of identifying them, but I did buy a special T-shirt when I was there, and it had a big slogan on it which said, "Only elephants should wear ivory." And the reason they had those T-shirts available was because they were trying to help stop the black market trade in ivory at the time, and they burnt this massive pyre of ivory. And so I bought that T-shirt, and I've always kept it. And many years later, when I gave birth to my second child, I was able to birth her at home, and I intentionally chose that T-shirt to wear as I birthed her. And when you mentioned before, you know, wearing clothing as a shield, or when somebody mentioned it, I thought, well, that's exactly why I wore that T-shirt, because that T-shirt was giving me some form of power in order to be able to birth.
Yeah. Extraordinary. And you still have that T-shirt, I'm guessing.
I do, and I am. Your last caller, Leanne, was talking about, you know, keeping clothing after somebody's passed. Well, I've actually decided I'm going to be cremated in that T-shirt. It's got such power for me. Yeah.
Wow, that is a really special T-shirt indeed. Leanne, thank you so much for calling and sharing a story about that special T-shirt. Really appreciate it on Life Matters this morning. I want to go over to Liz and Harriet just for some reaction there to some of the calls you're hearing. Liz, any themes jumping out at you so far?
I feel like the most obvious one to me is that the longer that we own our clothes, the more the memories are imbued, and the more that we're carrying not just like cloth through our lives, but the history of our lives, you know, like that T-shirt taking her from her 20s, you know, initially to the birth of her child, to like her future, you know, it's like cremation. I think that the longer that we own our clothes, the more memories, the more strength, and the more value they have. And that to me is just really beautiful.
Harriet, interesting text has just come in. I want you to address it with some historical context or analysis, please. The texter says, all clothes need pockets. Women's clothing in the past did not have pockets, and they had to make their own little pouches to carry essentials like coins and eating utensils. Yes, you know, what I saw a meme online, and the joke was that anytime a dress has pockets, that's the first thing a woman will say, you know, this has pockets, and we celebrate that. What is the issue with pockets, and what, I suppose, is the greater significance of so much of women's clothing not having pockets? Is there a political, ideological thing that we can read from this, or is it just simply no pockets?
Oh, absolutely. No, there is definitely a political aspect to the pocket debate. And lots has been written about pockets and the history of the little bags or the little pouches that women created to carry their things around in, which is kind of the precursor to the purse today, I guess. But in a lot of ways, not having pockets restricts women's movements, because then we need our hands occupied carrying our things. Whereas if you have pockets, you can put your things in your pockets and you have your hands free. So famously, I mean, she wasn't the first to put pockets in clothing, but Coco Chanel was famous for putting pockets in clothing to give women freedom of movement. So they could have pockets, put their things in. I mean, she loved a bag as well, but and then get on, for instance, a form of public transport. Other ways that pockets are useful is if women, and that's also the case with a bifurcated garment, so a garment like a trouser, so not a skirt, which means that women could ride a bicycle. So again, it's about freedom of movement, of getting around, of extending the domain of a woman outside of the home. And so I think it's incredibly political that the aspects of, you know, where you can put your paraphernalia on your body, whether you need your hands to do that or whether you can actually attach it to yourself in a pocket.
And the revelation of trying on a pair of pants made for men and understanding that their pockets go so deep
really
they can
deep.
Hold the keys
exactly.
and the phones with no issue.
Yeah.
It's mind-blowing.
Yeah, exactly.
Pockets are revolutionary. Let's go to Pauline in Goulburn, New South Wales. Pauline, you work in theatre and clothe actors. You must have some stories about clothes.
Indeed, I do. And I am custodian of a beautiful wardrobe, which is primarily filled with costumes that have been custom made for characters, or in fact, just an accumulation of period pieces that, or pieces from eras that 50s, 60s that people have donated. And I guess one of the stories I wanted to share was the fact that when we were staging a production of Cloud Street, it covered several decades, so I had the opportunity to pull costumes to clothe the actors from covering 40s, 50s and 60s. And I had young men who would turn up for rehearsal. They'd be in casual clothes, jeans, T-shirts, and they'd be put into a three-piece suit, and they would immediately stand tall and they'd wear this costume with such great pride and obviously take on a character immediately. But one of the things that stuck with me was the fact that they would say, I wish we could wear these clothes again. I wish I had the opportunity to wear these clothes. And the other thing that I felt really proud about that production was the fact that I was able to pull on shoes and handbags and gloves and cocktail dresses. So everything was there to tell a story, to paint a picture on stage.
It is so fascinating, isn't it, that when you put on an item of clothing, your posture, your body language, your whole manner can change. Liz, can I come to you, you know, in your time documenting fashion on the streets and also on runways, how have you seen that kind of come to life?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I felt it personally. There's been many an outfit. I went to an event two nights ago and I wore a particularly special jacket, a jacket that I've been waiting to wear for an occasion. I've had it for well over a year and it's just been sitting in my wardrobe waiting to be worn. And I did feel 10 centimetres taller. I felt like I could talk to anyone in the room. I felt really confident. I felt really like that jacket was holding me as I sort of moved through the space. And I think I've seen that time and time again on the street. I've had one of the best jobs, I think, ever, where I actually walk around and I get to talk to women and compliment them. And when I meet someone on the street who has dressed up that little bit more and say to them, oh my gosh, you look amazing, you know, tell me about your outfit, can I take your picture? They sort of say that the people around them maybe don't appreciate or comment or compliment them as much as, you know, they're surprised by the compliment. And I think that it kind of goes hand in hand. Like the way that we're dressing in a more casual way, I wonder if it speaks to our like vulnerability and not wanting to stand out and not wanting to feel seen in case nobody does notice. Yeah, I'm not sure if that makes sense, but I feel like there's something in that.
Okay, wonderful. We are going to go to our very final caller. That's Lynn. Lynn, you're our lucky last. We have about 1 minute. What do you want to tell us about your clothing story?
Well, I've been very interested in all the previous ones, so that's good. Hi, Beverly. Now, I have polio, and I've found that over the years, the things that used to be fashionable but had full zips, I can no longer wear. I've had to give away all my jackets with full zips because I cannot close them at the bottom. I can't put my hands together and actually, you know, fit the zip in. And so I wear half zips now. That's just one of those things. And pockets. Boy, do I need pockets.
Yes. Well, Harriet, in the I'm going to just sneak out another 30 seconds for you to, for a final word on the importance of accessibility in fashion.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that was coming up to me in all of these stories is that our bodies change over time and our perhaps our abilities change as well. So, you know, we can aspire to keep our clothes forever, but I think this is a beautiful story that reminds us that sometimes things don't fit us anymore or we can't wear things anymore. And so finding an alternative home for them is a nice way to pass them on, to have a second life to someone else who maybe does have the accessibility required to wear those jackets or to wear clothes that maybe don't fit our own body anymore. So thinking about the ongoing life of our clothes, even if it has to, if they have to leave our own wardrobe, I think is really important.
I want to thank you both so much for joining me on Life Matters this morning. And we've just had such a wide-ranging and interesting conversation on the importance of personal fashion that's touched on sustainability, accessibility, disability, so many touch points. Thank you so much, Liz Sunshine, fashion photographer and creator of the Not Buying Clothes Project and the Smith Street Agency, and Dr. Harriet Richards, senior lecturer in the School of Fashion and Textiles at RMIT University. And next up, what do you do when your new work colleagues' eating habits are ruining your weekly team lunch? Well, we will be asking the aunties to help.
On ABC Radio National,
the arts aren't just entertainment.
They're part of who we are.
Andy Griffiths.
He ended up at the centre of the earth fighting the peanut butter beast.
Now, Ben O'Cree.
Put their hands up if they have never been brokenhearted.
The changing nature of performance and recording in Australia.
From books to music and far beyond,
the arts are just one way Radio National
explores the world in full.
Most offices have an unspoken etiquette around how to eat in shared spaces, but what happens when a colleague grossly misinterprets those rules? And I mean, like, very, very gross. That's when we ask Auntie. And helping us whet our appetites, columnist Robert Skinner, the author of I'd Rather Not, and comedian, writer, actor, producer Irvi Majumdar, whose TV pilot Irvi Went to an All-Girls School is up on iView now. Go watch it.
Thank you. Hey.
Not right now, though, but later. Okay, aunties. Today's letter is all about what happens when people have different standards when it comes to eating in a shared space. Robert, I understand you've lived in multiple share houses over the years. Have you ever come across gross misinterpretation or differing interpretations of how to eat in shared spaces? That was unique.
Oh yeah, well we had a housemate who was a big porridge eater, and one time she was away and we couldn't find any bowls, so we had to sort of like bust into her room, and there were like the whole room was covered with bowls of sort of half or quarter eaten porridge.
Like a horror movie, but porridge.
Yeah, and then at some point they'd started to grow mold, which she obviously recognised as a problem. But instead of moving out of the room, she just covered each one in Glad wrap.
Okay, that's very interesting. That write us a letter, Robert. Tell us about how that went. Irvi, what about you? Different interpretations of eating in shared spaces. How's that gone for you?
I feel like it's going okay. I feel like sometimes I'm the culprit. I'm not saying I'm doing porridge stuff, but I feel like I've been extra sensitive to it in the past because my family's Indian, so, you know, I have curries and I do love eating, I love a soup for breakfast. And I think the only time I've done that wrong is when I brought it into a really hot room and someone was like, so now we have 10 people in this hot room plus a hot soup. So after that, I was more careful.
Yeah, look, absolutely. This idea, you know, people of color, ethnic kids, you know, having the people shame them for their lunch is a conversation, a situation that many of us can relate to. Soup for breakfast, that's okay. I have been known to eat, I love a savory, I will never eat porridge for breakfast if I can help it. I detest porridge, but I will eat leftover savory pasta for breakfast. Yeah. And I'm proud to say that on Radio National. Okay, so let's talk about our letter writer, Jasmine, what she's struggling with. And part one of her letter is, a new staff member recently started at our office was assigned to the desk next to mine. At first, she seemed lovely, so I was looking forward to having a new long-term desk buddy. However, pretty quickly, I started noticing an escalating range of odd and frankly gross food habits. The first thing I noticed was the way my colleague eats her banana. Instead of eating it the quote normal way, the stem at the top, I guess, she'd first remove the peel with her long fake nails, leave it in the space between our desks, and then eat it. Okay. Then she started bringing in a boiled egg for her morning snack. She'd crack it on the desk, peel the shell, and leave it on top of the banana peel for most of the day. I have a particular ick factor about eggs, so I thought I might be being overly sensitive, so I let it slide. Okay, let's pause and check in with the aunties. Irvi, what are your thoughts on what Jasmine sees as her new colleague's habits, the banana peel apparently left out and the shell on the desk?
Yeah, I think that's really rude. I feel like I just had a banana outside and I, because it's a little bit brown, I walked a further distance and then I ate it there.
Oh my goodness.
And I feel like that, I just didn't even connect that we were talking about this now. So I feel like it's rude. That's not a normal behavior.
An immediate case study of how a polite person eats
except I was sitting next to Irvi and I was sort of disappointed that she walked off. Because one, I was deprived of her company, and also, you know, the chance of a bite at a banana.
So. Okay, next time. Robert, though, what do you think about this desk buddy's behavior so far?
Well, I don't think it's that weird a way to eat a banana. I mean, if she ate the skin and left the rest of it, that would be weird.
Okay. Okay.
But leaving it between the desk, like, that's gross.
Just letting it take the air before eating it.
Yeah, the air's a problem. My mum used to make me delicious, like, sort of goulash sandwiches on Turkish bread.
Oh.
She's German.
Yeah.
Which I think would be delicious served up straight, but once they've been in your school bag
a bit soggy
for half the day, then smelly, you know, just emanate.
Yeah.
And I guess that's a problem with bananas and eggs, right?
Mm. Okay. That's very interesting. Let's move on to part two of Jasmine's saga. Each Friday, says Jasmine, we have a special weekly team lunch. There are six of us now that my new colleague has joined the group. It's an important time to connect with everyone on the team. Last week, this new colleague brought shell pasta. What she didn't bring was a fork. Instead, she used the aforementioned fake nails to stab each shell. She then proceeded to pull each shell off the nail with her teeth. Oh boy, aunties, please come in. Tell me what your thought, Robert. You seem like quite a tolerant person, very open, non-judgmental. What about this situation? What's your read of the fake nails stabbing the pasta shell?
Well, you know, times are tough. Forks cost money. I kind of admire the resourcefulness.
Okay.
Like, it wouldn't be very, it would be...
If you were sitting across from a person who was doing this, how would you feel about being in that presence while you yourself are trying to eat your lunch?
I don't know. It sounds half gross and a half kind of hot.
Yeah.
Financially, it would be crazy if she was paying for fake nails in order to eat the pasta.
Interesting.
In that case,
that's expensive.
I'd be like, probably just buy a fork.
Yeah. Okay. Irvi, how's this landing with you?
Yeah, I think it's psycho. I feel like that's so weird to do. I just feel like I think I'd be disturbed. But it's the kind of thing that if you are a writer or something, I'd take notes and just put that in a book or like a joke somewhere. But it's not normal.
What do you think if we could put ourselves not in the mind of Jasmine? We know how she feels, but from the perspective of the person with the long nails, like, what do you think is happening with that choice, Robert?
Well, I don't know. I guess you look for something to pick them up with and you look down at your own hands and there they are. They're
yeah.
perfect.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, look, Indian people eat with their hands,
yes.
right? So
yep.
from that lens, how's that landing?
It is really interesting. I was thinking about this. So I feel like, okay, one, if I'm in the mind of that person, I think she's doing it for attention or maybe like COVID's just kind of like, we're a bit weird after COVID.
Yeah.
But in India, we do eat with our hands, but there's like a whole different etiquette. Like you can't have, my parents hate long nails and it's like, they even like with nail polish, it's hard and you can't get any food in the palm of your hand. It has to be with your fingers. So like when little kids learn to eat, they like their mums will usually like roll it into balls for them. So yeah. there's like a whole process.
There's a whole skill. There's yeah. a whole art to it. Yeah. 100%. Okay.
So it's not a lack of etiquette. That's just a different.
It's a whole different.
My parents would, if I was eating with my nails like that, they would absolutely tell me off at okay. home. Yeah.
Okay. We're not finished yet with Jasmine, so let's continue. Jasmine says, when I saw my colleague eating like this, it nearly made me puke in my mouth. Not to mention that at the end of lunch, she wiped her bowl with a napkin and put it back on her desk for the next time sans washing. I'm assuming next to the banana peel and the eggshell. I don't think I can keep going to these lunches if I'm going to have to watch the way this woman eats, not to mention the eggshells and banana peels. How should I address it? Okay. Aunties, Jasmine is repulsed, not just because of the fingernail situation, but also not washing the bowl. Robert, you were sort of turned on by the situation.
I don't know. It kind of sounds like she's camping. Like maybe she's not planning on staying in the job very long.
Okay. So don't worry about the situation that may not last.
I mean, I haven't worked in an office before. I've only recently begun working indoors.
Group lunches, not really a thing you're super familiar with.
Yeah, but I remember one time asking a friend about a different. Actually, it was the same housemate.
The porridge one.
Yeah. And so two of my other housemates were quite keen on sort of like having an intervention and talking to her. And my friend said, you've got two options. You can either just kick her out or do her dishes. It's like, it's throwing good money after bad, trying to get people to change.
Are you suggesting that Jasmine just wash the bowl for her, supply a fork?
Maybe.
Irvi, how do you feel about
I know
addressing the situation?
It's a tricky one because it's not something that you can just, I don't think it's that appropriate to just like full on tell her out, to like call her out. But if it was me personally, I'd just do like passive aggressive things. Like I would hand her a fork when she was eating with her nails and just be like, oh, did you want to use this instead? I think that's like a kind of low key way to address it.
Yeah. I mean, yes.
Does it depend slightly on whether Jasmine's objections are practical or moral?
Okay, expand in the 30 seconds, 40 seconds that we have.
Well, if it's a moral objection, then, you know, that's a much more bitter pill to swallow. But if she thinks it could be solved just with a fork and a wet
right.
cloth, then, you know, she could presumably pony them up herself.
I do think actually the dishwashing is something you can directly say because that can just be like, do you mind just not leaving the stuff on my desk, which mm-hmm. is a shared space in an office?
Yeah. Really interesting how they are such different styles to what constitutes being acceptable in the lunch. I mean, I think what Jasmine is worried about, if I can read between the lines, is she's kind of on the line about whether she should continue going to these lunches because she is both repulsed and uncomfortable. What do you think about that option of actually exiting herself?
I personally wouldn't do that just because I imagine there's like other people there and you want to be like included in the group still. But I would either, this is immature, but you could even like start a union with the other people and gang up.
I mean, that is a danger,
something.
Right? Like if you are in a group situation, you might notice it, but talking to somebody else in the group could result in a kind of unhealthy dynamic, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe Jasmine wants a different job entirely.
Oh, okay. So maybe the solution is that Jasmine... No, come on. Jasmine's asked us for help. I don't know if we should suggest that Jasmine should look for another job.
I don't think she should let that woman win. I feel like she should address it in small ways, be passive aggressive, and then I think the problem will resolve.
Fantastic. Be passive aggressive. Always good advice. Thank you so much to our aunties. Robert Skinner, a columnist and author of I'd Rather Not... and comedian and writer Irvi Majumdar. If you have a pressing social dilemma or crisis of conscience that needs talking out, please do get in touch. Write to lifematters@abc.net.au. Put Ask Auntie in the subject line so we can see it clearly. I'm Beverly Wang. Thank you for your company on Life Matters today. I'm going to hand over to Tegan Taylor, who will be back with you on Monday with more of your favorite stories from the year.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.